welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Chad Scheel, and he'll be answering your most important question about fly fishing, Art of War. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Chad a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll try to answer your questions on the show as we progress through the show. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. Content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Chad Scheel about fly fishing, Art of War. The Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. The Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon, Trophy, Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com. That's wyotrout.com. Or call them at 1-307-237-5997. That's 307-237-5997. Well, before we introduce Chad, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight on our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Chad's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form. We'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away 2 special gifts tonight, courtesy of Chad Scheel and Emerge Fly Fishing Specialties. And that's going to be a $50 and a $25 gift certificate. And you can redeem those at www.emergefishing.com for either warm water type flies, rods, saltwater flies, and many other products that Chad has available there. So here's how to win those. You have to be the first person to answer questions that I ask at the end of the show. And the questions will be about something we talk about during the show. And the first person to submit the answer through the text box on our homepage, the same text box you can use during the show to ask questions, use that to submit your answer along with your name and your location. You've got to have both of those at the end of the show when we ask the question. And the first person that answers it correctly will get these prizes. Well, tonight our guest is Chad Scheel. Chad was born and raised in Colorado, where he's been fishing since age 6. At age 18, he enlisted in the U.S. Marine Corps and served 5 honorable years as an intelligence analyst. During his time in service, he introduced many of his fellow Marines to the art and sport of fly fishing. Chad currently lives in Foothill Ranch, California, with his wife Jackie. He's the owner of Emerge Fly Fishing Specialties and spends a great deal of his time instructing new anglers, developing warm water tactics, and inventing new fly patterns. He has created an entire line of brilliantly developed and creative flies for Rainey's Flies and Supplies out of Logan, Utah, and his fly patterns can be found in fly shops throughout the country and abroad. Today, Chad has caught 34 different species of fish on fly rod. His travels have given him the opportunity to fish in both salt and freshwater environments. He is a self-taught fly tire and angler who enjoys sharing his passion and experience with others. Chad, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks for having me, Roger, and I'd just like to say it's a real honor to be on your show.
Oh, well, good to have you, good to have you. Hopefully we can have some fun and we can all learn a few things here tonight. And
I'm sure we will.
That's right. So. Okay, well, folks, we've got kind of an unusual title tonight for Chad's show, so I think we should probably clear this up about that title and where we're going with this show. So, Chad, that's the first question I ask you. We titled the show Fly Fishing Art of War. Can you explain what this means to you and, how it relates to fly fishing?
Absolutely, Roger. You know, to really understand what fly fishing art of war is, you have to first understand what the reasoning behind needing such an approach is. And I can't tell you how many people I come across today when I'm working at these shows and just out on the water of people who want to fly fish in locations outside of their trout streams, but they don't know where to start. You know, they show up to the water, they're just mind-boggled by a massive reservoir, lake, or the ocean, and they just, you know, they just kind of are in awe, and they just don't know where to begin. So to answer your question of what is fly fishing art of war, I define it as an organized approach to finding and catching fish while continuously evaluating and assessing the weather, enemy, and terrain of your fishery. Now, we should continue clarifying a little bit. The acronym, I use an acronym called WET, which stands for weather, enemy, terrain. However, I do not consider fish to be our enemy, you know, that, you know, we respect fish and we want to practice catch and release. It's not about going about destroying fish or waging war like, you know, some people might think. It's rather just, it's a means of approaching the water with an actual assessment, an actual educated assessment on where to find fish as opposed to just blind casting and getting lucky. And so that's the reason why I use that term, enemy. And it's also because it's an actual military intelligence term that we used in the Marines to evaluate our battle space. And it's easy to remember. You know, who can forget WET when you're out on the water? So it's just an easy approach to get out there and start putting together all these pieces of the puzzle and then start pinpointing where these fish are at. So.
Okay. And we did have a couple of questions, both from Steve Bourne and Madison, Wisconsin, and Peter mm-hmm. Gorinsky in Costa Rica regarding that, because I think they kind of misinterpreted just didn't understand where the title had come from the show. But
yeah.
They said in their questions, we, you know, we all enjoy the calm and the pleasure and the serenity of being out on the water and enjoying
exactly.
fly fishing, and this doesn't change that at all.
It doesn't change that at all. In fact, it's not like, you know, you're not going out there to shoot fish in a barrel like the statement says, or, you know, going out there with sticks of dynamite. You're just going out there and you're just maintaining a very stealthy approach and a very knowledgeable and intelligence-based approach when you're on the water. And it applies more to your reservoirs, your lakes, and these big fisheries where, as opposed to your streams. It does affect the streams as well. But, you know, so much literature and knowledge is already founded around trout fishing with a fly rod. So we know so much there. But when you want to expand, you need to have an approach to pinpoint certain locations. Having said that, and kind of expanding on what both Steve and Peter were talking about there, if you think about it, it really is almost like a battle between you and the fish. After all, the fish does view us as an enemy. They don't want to see us. They don't want to hear from us. They certainly don't want to be caught and released. So going about it with a battle-like approach, in a sense, is a really good way to put yourself in the element, you know, because after all, every creature in nature is practicing stealth. It's practicing, you know, blending in with its surroundings, and it has a knowledge of what's happening out there. So it's a great way to do that, and it doesn't take away from the serenity or anything. In fact, it just, you know, puts you out there with just a bit more knowledge. That's all it really does.
Right. So, well, what mistakes do men, you know, when people aren't applying the WET approach, what are many of the mistakes that many fly fishers make when fishing a new or even previously fished waters if they didn't fish it right in the first place? What kind of mistakes do people make?
Well, you know, we in fly fishing, in not just stream fishing, but all fishing, we use the term match the hatch. We're all familiar with the phrase. We understand it. Having said that, a lot of times when you show up to the water and we're all familiar with not having a hatch to match. And, you know, it's not the case so much on our streams because we understand enough there. But when we go out and we're trying to match the hatch for warm water fishing baits, you know, and salt water and stuff, a lot of times we just are looking in the wrong place. I find that most fly fishermen know how to match the hatch. Their issue really arises more from finding a hatch to match. And if you can't find the food, you cannot find your predator fish. That's probably the biggest mistake that I see on the water. The largest mistake that I see is when people first show up on the water, they're overly aggressive to get out there and start casting immediately. They don't take the time to just take a few minutes, step back, overlook the big body of water and say, okay, there's a chance we can pick up fish here based on what we know. And we'll go into this more in detail on how to use weather and the enemy, and I'll constantly refer to the fish as the enemy, but like I clarified, that's not the case. And then the terrain and what the weather effects are on the terrain and how those two elements are going to affect your fish and where they could be moving. And so that's probably another thing that people are just doing. They just walk up to the bank and they start casting immediately. And when you start doing that, it's a huge distraction because you're fishing, sure, and you're getting your quiet time on the water, but you're not really catching as many fish as you could be.
Yeah, but as you arrive there, Chad, all excited and ready to go.
I know.
It's awful hard to stop and calm down and analyze and,
You're exactly right, especially when, most of us get out on the weekends, I mean, how hard is it, when you maybe get like an hour and a half in the evening or maybe a day a week or something, that's tough because you're exactly right. It's exciting, So, but there's more excitement, the person that waits and the person that assesses things is going to get into the thick of things, whereas that's not going to be the case with most of your anglers,
Right. You use this, the wet approach when you fish new waters, or are you constantly using it even if it's waters you fished before? Do you go back to this wet approach? Does it give you a distinct advantage?
Yeah. It does give you an advantage because every fishery is going to have, multiple elements. Lots of things going on. You got a hatch going on. You had a rainstorm a couple of days ago. It's hot out today. You got all these different elements, atmospheric pressure. And so when you get out there, you can use it, here and there if you'd like. But, I've been using it for 3 years. I didn't realize how structured my approach was on the water until I was actually giving a class and just talking to a couple guys and about going out and fishing streamers that I realized that this whole time I had been using this wet approach. And that so much of my success had been around what I had learned in the military and applying that to my fishing because I noticed that I wasn't missing elements. So for me, it's almost integrated in who I am. I'm constantly thinking about it when I'm out there. I'm constantly reevaluating things. But for the new angler, it can be difficult to apply, but it's a learning process, and it's a process that you can always continue adding to. And so that's a major benefit of it.
So right,
it is
right.
Beneficial. It's very beneficial.
Let's start talking about the wet approach and breaking it down. First, weather, right, is number one.
Right.
And, after asking the question I just asked, I thought, while you were answering, I thought, even on waters you fished before, the weather can always change. So it may not at all be what it was the last time you were there, and the scheme of things could have changed. So, yeah, sure, this is very important. I want to relate because of this coming from your military experience. How was weather used in battlefield preparation? How do you relate that to fly fishing? What did you do there and how did you take it here?
Yeah, we used weather, back during my military service. We used it for the same purpose as you can in fly fishing. We used it mainly to understand what the battlefield effects would be. So obviously the weather is going to affect your terrain and your surroundings. Different kind of soils and whatnot are affected by moisture, snow, what have you. We would use that to then determine, paths that we could take that would actually be suitable if we had a rainstorm, That way we wouldn't get, bogged down by, enemy fire or something like that. We also used it to kind of, understand, because if you use these three elements, you can also kind of understand what the weather's effect is on your enemy. And what it's going to do to their equipment and their terrain and everything else. So it integrates. All three elements integrate. So when you carry that back over to fly fishing, it's the exact same thing. The weather will affect the terrain. In fact, without weather, terrain would really just stand still. It'd freeze in time with the exception of human and other animal involvement. All of our canyons, all of our sandbars, everything that's out there in our fishery has been created by an element of weather. And I break down the weather into a couple different types, basically. You got your sunlight, you got your moon data, you have your water, we'll just call it, rain, snow, what have you, and then also your atmospheric pressure. So those are the three things that will affect your fishery tremendously.
Okay. So, and you say tremendously, so
yeah.
I'm getting the feeling that this could have a major effect on your success on any given day.
Absolutely, and I would probably consider the weather to be the key. If you understand the weather, and if the listeners tonight only walk away with a little bit. I hope that they will walk away understanding that weather is the biggest part of this puzzle, because your terrain will be affected by it. Your fish will be affected by it. And even yourself will be affected by it. After all, sometimes the weather's so bad it keeps us from even going out at all. So just think about that and what that's going to do to the fish. You can easily relate it. And, you know, I'll just give you an example. A rainstorm. Let's say you're fishing, the lower part of a mountain range, in a nice river, and everything's clean and clear. You go home, you've had a great day. It was picture perfect, clean water. You go home, you get a little rain that night, and you come back the next morning. Things changed, and it depends on how much rain was received. If it's just a little bit, fishing might be better. Fishing might be the same. It might be a little bit more challenging. But if it was certainly a lot of rain, I mean, things could be completely shut down entirely. So it can have a huge effect on things, absolutely.
Okay, you mentioned several factors. We do have a question from Gary Powell in Memphis, Tennessee, and okay. I guess he splits his time in Jackson Hole, Wyoming as well. So, Chad, what kinds of weather conditions or changes increase the fish's aggressiveness, and what kinds put them down?
Okay.
Also, does it help to have a camo fly rod? Just kidding. Or tanks.
That's funny.
Well, I could have used a tank, I think.
I'll say, if you had it, you know what, if you can afford a tank, all your high-class fly rods aren't expensive enough, but if you can afford a multi-million-dollar tank, then by all means,
yeah.
Gary, knock yourself out.
You
know, if you think about it, you know, so much of the waders and things that we already wear are already neutral color. They're olives and grays, and that already kind of helps us to blend into our backgrounds. You know, so that answers your camo question. Now, if you wanted to do face paint and a ghillie suit, knock yourself out, I'm sure you do tremendously. The fish wouldn't even know you were there. But having said that, talking about the weather conditions that increase the fish's aggressiveness, probably one of the greatest things that will affect a fish's aggressiveness is the barometric pressure. I'm sorry, the atmospheric pressure that we can measure using a barometer. Now, we'll just go through all of these and just kind of explain them.
Sure.
You have your high pressure, you have your normal or stable pressure, which is what we consider to be, just the standard. So when I say standard and we're talking about this, that's kind of our midway point. That's all right. And then obviously we have our low pressure. There's four methods of measuring atmospheric pressure. However, for weather reasons and when you go to the Weather Channel and whatnot, they only use one of two. And in America here we use a term called inches of mercury, and it basically measures the atmospheric pressure 1 inch in height at 32 degrees Fahrenheit, and its standard is 29.92. Now, just to show you how small this range is, its high record is only 32. That's the high world record for that pressure. And then its low, which was during a typhoon, was only 25.7. So you can see there's a very small range there, so it's very hard to, like, really kind of develop that range. So when you're talking about barometric pressure and rolling into that and trying to understand what's high, what's low, I prefer the metric way of reading it, which is what the world uses, and that measures in millibars. And the standard for that is 1013.25. And so you get a much higher number reading, so that it's easier to identify. So let's just go through all of these. We'll just start at our, let's just go ahead and start in the middle, with normal and stable pressure. Okay. You know, usually in those cases, your weather is fair. There's really not a whole lot going on. You have a little bit of cloud cover perhaps, and let's just call this our normal fishing. Okay. We're going out. This is just a normal day. What I would recommend is that you just experiment with your favorite flies when you're out there on the water, drives and inflips, streamers, what have you. Now, when we're talking about getting those aggressive fish, and when we're looking for an opportunity on our water when things are extremely aggressive and we're maybe getting into one fish every two or three casts, and when you find that, that's great. Then in those cases, we're usually talking about falling pressure, and the weather is usually degrading. So in this case, a storm is building or a storm is moving in. If you think about it in logical terms, really the atmosphere around you is getting higher. Getting heavier. So the pressure is now exerting lower levels on you. That's usually when you have your most active fishing, and that's when you can go out and you can use aggressive and very fast approaches on the water. You can, for a wiper, for example, or strike bass, you can, you know, throw those deceivers, and you can really strip them almost as fast as you can, and they'll almost always catch them. That's because those fish are really aggressive and on the move. as things continue to get lower, you have a slightly lower range. Now you're getting into some clouds and stuff. Not raining or anything yet. The atmosphere hasn't really started falling per se, like in the form of rain. But those fish are, at that point, they're either going to continue feeding aggressively, or they're going to start at that point going out into the bigger lakes and starting to seek a little bit of cover. At that point, they're starting to find a more stable place where the pressure change isn't as great.
And then, so as let's make sure I'm following you, when you say at the beginning stage of the pressure change moving down, lower pressure range, the change itself may initiate some aggressiveness or some feeding behavior, but if it continues to go down, then they sense, oh, something may be wrong here, I better go find cover, right?
It's not that things are wrong, it's just that the change is starting to change so greatly. And, you know, that's usually when you start getting extremely low pressure, like that, or low pressure, you're starting to really almost have a storm. It's almost ready to rain, or something along those lines. So when that's the case, then those fish are going to start seeking out areas that they can just hold out for the storm, you know.
Right.
And I don't want to, this isn't the case for all fish. This is just a general knowledge for your game fish. Fish that go out and actively hunt, wipers, striped bass. Your largemouth bass, it kind of depends, you know, because they're sometimes a little bit finicky. So, but they will usually be a little bit more aggressive and on the move as well. And then when things get, you know, when your pressure gets extremely low, we're talking about the lowest pressure, and it's really in relation to how we measure pressure. It's not even extremely low when you look at how it's measured, but it's low enough to cause great enough change to the fish, and then those fish are usually just seeking out cover. Some of them will continue to feed, but that's usually how that goes. And then when the pressure starts rising, just kind of doing opposite of what Gary has asked, your fish are going to be less aggressive and less likely to feed when the pressure starts rising. And those fish will become less inactive. They're going to start going to deeper locations. Usually this is the case because now your skies are extremely clear. It's sunny. Your temperatures in the shallows are going to get hot. And so you can kind of see how it all kind of relates to itself. And those fish are going to seek cover usually during those periods. Most fish, you know. Some fish are the exception, like carp, for example.
So, would you say carp?
Yeah, like, you know, carp are kind of an interesting fish because a lot of times when things warm up, they will continue feeding. I mean, they have such a wide range for living in water that they're not as affected by barometric pressure and weather as some of these other fish are.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that answers his question. I guess I expanded a little bit on it, but I think I just
fine.
Went and cover the atmospheric pressure all onto that question.
Yeah, well, we need to take a little break here. When we come back, talk more about weather and the other facets of it. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. Keeney's Fly Shop has an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 1-800-400-0359. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Chad Scheel about fly fishing art of war. If you'd like to ask Chad a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And, folks, I do encourage you to send in questions. Tonight's show is a little bit different because you didn't know what to ask ahead of time too much because we didn't give you a whole lot of information. So feel free to send those questions in, and we'll see what we can do with them. One thing that I just thought of was when he had talked about the camo rod, it reminded me of many, many people that have been fly fishing for a while. I remember Gary LaFontaine, who has passed away, and I know there was a story about him buying brand new rods and going out and taking fine sandpaper and sanding down the rods so they wouldn't glare in the sun. And he was a very accomplished, well-respected fly fisher, so we can kind of laugh at the camo rod or those kind of things, but some people really think they can make a difference, so I think we might keep that in mind. Well, Chad, before we continue, I wanted to have you tell folks a little bit about what you're doing out there in the fly fishing world, about Emerge Fly Fishing Specialties, and maybe, you know, you can mention some of the things you're doing with your business and the flies you've been designing and so forth.
Okay. Well, thanks, Roger. Yeah, my purpose in fly fishing that I feel that I'm drawn to is really just maintaining a true art element of fly fishing. For me, that's what really drew me to the sport when I was younger, was everything about it was just an art. The tying of flies, the rods, the casting, I just fell in love with that element of the fishing. And so at Emerge Fishing, I try and really maintain that element. And if, you know, people look at my custom rods and stuff, and they are unlike anything that you will ever find, because the cork and everything else, I mean, it is true cork artwork that I'm doing and that I want to share with people. The same thing with the flies. I probably spend just as much time hunched over a vise as I do out on the water and just developing flies that are unique and they work great, and those are the things that I find important. And and then sharing the knowledge. I just love sharing the information that I have and the theories that I'm out there doing on the water every day. And so it's just a lot of fun. You know, it's the most rewarding line of work I think anybody could be in. So that's what I've been up to. So now I'm just, because I did recently move to California, like you said, I'm just kind of reestablishing things here. My wife and I moved back for personal reasons. We had met here. We were living in Colorado to both attend school there. So now we're back here, and so I'm getting back into the saltwater scene, which I had given up for a couple of years when I moved to Colorado, and just having a great time. So meeting a lot of great people, and it's been a lot of fun.
Okay, now what's your website name? How can people get in contact with you?
Yeah, the website is www.emerge, E-M-E-R-G-E, fishing.com, no spaces or dashes. At the site, you can find all the pictures and everything of what we're doing. There's a full fly shop where you can buy flies there. At this point, I have mostly the flies that I've designed on there, and I'm looking to expand that this coming season by adding a whole bunch of other work from, you know, Kelly Gallup and Dave and the rest of the group. So you can get it all there, and then there's also free articles, free videos, and I'm doing a lot of that stuff as well. So
great. Yeah, I have to say that Chad's warm water flies, like salamander, frogs, and so forth that he's designed, are incredible. And he's got some great videos out there that if you go to his site, you can see how these things work underwater. And that's really quite interesting. So for sure, go check out his site and look at some of those videos. Chad, we just got a question in over the Internet here. Deb Freely in London, Ontario, Canada says, I think we've all been here, Deb. You drive for a couple hours or go hours by plane to go fishing, get the gear ready, and the temperature pressure drops, and the fish shut off. Is there anything you can do to save the day other than tie flies and sample scotch?
Well, the sampling scotch don't sound too bad, but after all, you did fly into fish, not to sample scotch. Well, you know, there is something that I do when I'm out in the water. Some fish, I hate to tell you this, Deb, but some fish, they just, that the sun really hasn't started hitting those flats, they can have an easier time kind of sneaking around and ambushing prey because it's not extremely well lit yet. And a lot of times those fish are mostly nocturnal feeders. And so when you get out there in the low light hours, you're picking up those fish. But that sunlight in those areas has a tremendous effect on that location. And the water, it's not uncommon in some places for the water temperature to change maybe, you know, 2 or 3 degrees in a day. You know, when you first get out there to the end of the day. And it just depends on how much sunlight it gets. And it also depends on how much wind has been moving the water around and kind of mixing it up. If it's just been glass all day and it's been flat, then that water really isn't moving a whole lot. So the change will be greater in those kind of circumstances. Uh-huh. And so things start warming up. Midday, it's not uncommon for those fish to leave those locations, move out just beyond the shallows on kind of ridges and extreme drop-off points, or even more shallow drop-off points where the sunlight isn't as intense, the water temperature change isn't as intense, and yet they can still pick up multiple food sources that are cruising through those locations.
Well, I'm sure you'll talk a little bit more about this when we talk about the fish next, but yeah, a couple things come to mind here. One is, you know, you talked about not just temperature changes during the day, but, you know, what the trend has been, you know. And that trend could be, like you say, seasonally created in that, I think the pike will sense that temperature change and look for, start moving into shallows to spawn because it kicks in their spawning instinct, temperature change. Yeah. You just mentioned maybe, with warm water fishing those shallows maybe early morning. And that reminded me of a thing in Bill Edrington, who we had on the show a couple of times, fishes the Arkansas River in Colorado, and we talked to him about the Cadisach down there. And it's kind of a funny thing where they say, well, if you're going to fish the Arkansas, go get up and go have yourself a nice breakfast at the cafe, enjoy yourself, and, don't worry about getting out on the water till 10 o'clock because that's when the temperature has risen high enough for the caddis to start to hatch. And the fish don't start feeding heavily until the caddis start hatching. It all makes sense when you think about it, but you could flail that water at 6 in the morning on the Arkansas and get no results, and then all of a sudden at 10 o'clock, things start happening.
So. Well, and just kind of add to that point, isn't it funny how that philosophy of getting a nice big breakfast and hanging out and drinking coffee for a couple hours completely goes against what most fly fishermen do and the, just the general mindset? Because, most of us go out early. That is the general idea. But, I really try not to generalize too much because when you start doing that, then you're just kind of wasting your time. Every body of water is different. And that's kind of what this wet approach does for you. It lets you take all three of those elements into consideration and then move forward with an actual true direction and not just getting lucky or, and it's not a guarantee. There's no guarantees in fishing, but it's certainly going to put you a whole lot closer than you ever would have been.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's, of course we all know the military is a very structured environment and you're just moving that structure and organization to the fly fishing world, which a lot of us need.
Really? Well, and, I've noticed that it helped me because I remember when I was, I love catching trout, and going out. That's the most enjoyable, relaxing thing. But when I find myself on a reservoir and I actually have a boat or something, you're given a boat. You're given a power tool to get out there and get the job done. And so the atmosphere is different. You are relaxing, but the fish are different. They're built for speed. They're aggressive. They're powerful fish. And so the whole atmosphere is different. And so, you need a different approach. And having that structure helps. And, and the thing that people don't fully understand is that not only, going back to that military and structure thing, it is a structured environment, but so many of the structures are really developed to get you through some very unstructured times and just keep your mind on the game and get you to your next objective. And so that's why this works so well. Yeah.
Okay, a couple other things of
sure.
Weather related. Phase of the moon, does that, I guess that has something to do with pressure as well, but phase of the moon, tides?
I would think that it probably doesn't have anything to do with pressure so much because the sun is your greater source of energy in that. And so it might, I don't know for sure. The moon what's going to cause your tides, and everybody's kind of looking for that magical time to be out on the salt water, and everybody has a different philosophy. Some say it's a new moon or when the moon is black. Some people say it's a full moon or when it's at its brightest, if you can get out at night during those times. And I don't put too much emphasis around the moon at this point, and the reason is because I'm going out and my objective is really pinpointing where the fish are. And then I would usually pick up a couple. When the moon is at its brightest or at its darkest, it's not uncommon for fishing to be better. That's certainly the case. But, I use the moonlight more to really go out and stay out all night or to go out at night, and be able to see what I'm doing. That's the beauty of it for me, and I'm sure that the fish is relating to that too.
I think there probably needs to be more scientific data on that, but I've also heard certain people say they will not fish on a full moon.
Yeah,
they watch the moon phase, and if they see a full moon is going to be out for the next couple of days, they just won't go fishing because they feel like they don't have as good an effect when it's a full moon. So who knows?
And I talked to a guy at a reservoir a couple of weeks, about 2 weeks ago, who said, you're just wasting your time out here. So am I. But come out here, on the full moon, I think, and he gave me the dates, and I was like, oh, okay, So he swears by it. And so, I don't know. Like you said, there's not a whole lot of evidence, in my opinion, to yet back up exactly what's happening. So I don't put too much emphasis in that at this point. that it
Where can you get the best weather information for an area that you want to fish?
Absolutely. I have two main weather sources that I use. And the first one's a great, great resource. It's called the U.S. Naval Observatory. Now this one, this is a public site. Anybody can go to it. And this is the one I use every day when I was on active duty to collect sun and moon data. And it has down to the minute details. I mean, of when the sun is setting, when end of civil twilight is ending, which means that the sun is behind the horizon at exactly 5 degrees. So it's starting to get dark. The sky's got kind of a dark blue. And so you can really get some great information at that site and really start pinpointing, your sun and moon data. The other great site is just the Weather Channel. A couple of years ago, there wasn't much there, and I never used it. But now it has, full weather reports, atmospheric pressure. You can view it in both the metric system and the Mercury system. You can see live webcams of what's going on for just about every location, so you can actually get a true feel for what's happening. And so that's great. And then if you are on the oceans, and if you're, you need tide changes or tidal charts and things, for that I would just recommend Googling that information, because it's different in every location. So I don't have those. I haven't at least found one yet, a place where I can get all of that information at one site. So.
A lot of the local fly shops, too, will have that information.
Yeah.
But
exactly.
For the tides in their area, because it changes, too. I know down in the Keys, from one key to the next key, the tide can be totally different. Just because of the, the depth of the water and so forth. So,
exactly.
We did have a question that I'm going to throw it in here, but just the lack of putting it in somewhere else. But Jeff in Pennsylvania says, what products and techniques do you use to de-ice your guides in the winter? I haven't found a good one.
Well,
it fits in weather, I guess. But
yeah, well, that's certainly a weather question. I don't really use any product. Usually in the winter, I'm fishing tailwaters, and so there's really not a whole lot of ice in the water. The water's still pretty cold. So what I do is I will usually just dunk just the guides. I will kind of rest my rod almost on the bottom of the stream, because you don't want to get your reel in the water, because then it will freeze up entirely. So I'll just kind of just submerge those guides, and then the flowing water that moves over them will de-ice them quite well. And they'll freeze up again on you, depending on how cold it is. But at least that's the best means that I found. I used to break it out with my finger, but then I found that, that was bending the guide on occasion. And so, I don't know. I just prefer to just dunk the rod. It only takes a second to melt it, and then it will get you a good 5 minutes of fishing, and then you got to dunk it for another 10 to 12 seconds. That's what I do.
Right. Right. Well, here's another use for scotch that I found. One time I was up in by Kremlin, Colorado, fishing on the Colorado River in February, and boy, the eyelets were freezing up and stuff, and my reel must have had some grease or gunk in it or something. It was just, locking up and freezing up, and I did have a little flask of scotch, and a little scotch in the reel loosened it right up. Of course, it wasn't, I was kind of disappointed about not having as much scotch at that point, but,
got to
pick your battles, huh?
Yeah, because it is a water soluble, and yet it will, bust up grease and stuff, too, so.
Yeah.
But maybe you need to carry two flasks,
there you go.
And then, your low quality rubbing alcohol, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
But we need to take a quick break here, and then let's come back and talk about the enemy, or, as we also know them, our friends the fish. Pierre Marquette River Lodge, a full-service, Orvis-endorsed lodge, fly shop, and guide service located on the banks of the historic Pierre Marquette River in Baldwin, Michigan. They provide year-round lodging for the business or pleasure traveler, as well as a full-service fly shop and guided trips for steelhead, salmon, or large resident brown trout. For more information, visit www.pmlodge.com. That's pmlodge.com. Or call 231-745-3972. 231-745-3972. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Chad Scheel about fly fishing, art of war. If you'd like to ask Chad a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question, and we'll receive it immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay. Let's talk about the E in wet, which stands for enemy in the marine world, fish for us. You know, it's my understanding that that knowing your enemy is very important in war, and trying to predict their moves and so forth is very important to the Marines when they're scouting and planning an attack or an ambush or that kind of thing. So how do you apply those things to our quarry, the fish?
Absolutely. Well, and I'd kind of like to just make a point that, you know, it's the book Art of War, you know, it's a great book. It's a book that, you know, lots of people read. In fact, it's quoted in that movie. I think they call the movie Stock Market with Tom Cruise. He's constantly going around quoting that because it helps you to understand all your elements. So in this case, yeah, we just want to know more about our fish. Now, we could change, you know, the term enemy to fish, but then it would be WFT. It just wouldn't be as fun to say as wet, you know. It's easy to remember when you're on the water. Wet, you know, where am I? What am I doing? So, yeah, when you're out there on the water, this is an important thing to know. You need to know your fish. You need to know the quarry that you're after. In fly fishing, there is so much knowledge out there about trout fishing. So much of it. I mean, this whole sport, the whole fly fishing sport has evolved around trout, and it has evolved around being able to see what we're doing and being able to see the strike, being able to see the fish in shallow waters and rivers and such. But when you really start expanding outside of that, there is a lot of literature, especially, you know, over the last, you know, 20 to 50 years for the saltwater and other warm water species. You know, but for myself personally, I like to just go out and just fish for anything that swims. I mean, if it swims, I'm going to cast a fly to it until I catch it, at least, just, and then I'll decide if it's worth continuing to pursue. So, but when you start getting down to that level of wanting to fly fish and for different species and stuff, you need to really understand the fish. And, you know, you can catch fish. You can catch different species of fish without understanding them. You can go out and you can be successful, but your success is going to be very minimal. It's going to be more of a luck basis than anything else. But if you go out and you understand the fish and the actual individual fish, so let's say the carp, what is the carp? How can I catch it? And then we go out and we build a knowledge base for that fish, and then we go out and pursue them. Really, on a general, let's just break, just kind of look at fish, all in one massive category right now, just fish. If you really think about the life of a fish, I find that really a fish's life is very predictable, and yet it continues to elude every single fisherman on the water every single day. Really, a fish has to do three main things, and that is feed, avoid being fed on, and then also spawn. And everything else in between is just resting or making themselves comfortable and moving in relation to the weather and what have you. But, you know, from there we can start breaking it down even further. You know, for the enemy, in this category of the enemy or our fish, I like to then also examine what does the fish eat. You know, because after all, that is one third of what they do. You know, that's a big element of what that fish is doing out there. You know, I like to just kind of develop that knowledge. And you can do that by resourcing, you know, your information online. Fishbase.org is a great one. They have 30,000 different species of fish that you can read about. But when you're out in the field, and you can just kind of take an educated assessment at it as well. So let's say the carp. Let's say you've never caught a carp. Just watch the carp and think about what you know about the carp. We know that they are a big fish. We know that they're relatively lethargic until we get them mustered up and stirred up, and then they are extremely fast. They have their mouth orientated at a downward angle, which indicates that that fish is going to be a primary bottom feeder. And we can look at the color, and we can see a brown color that's going to help them to blend into their natural environment, which is going to be sandy bottoms and some weed bottoms and such. So right there, just off the bat, for that one fish, we've already kind of built an idea of what that fish is doing out there. So now we know, we can think, okay, so we're going after a carp, a bottom-feeding fish. I know that just by looking at his mouth. Okay, I'm going to put something heavy on the bottom, you know, a crawfish pattern or a leech that will get down to their level. You know, and then there are exceptions like, you know, the grass carp, for example, you know, for grass, and they'll eat grass off the top and things like that. But primarily they're a bottom feeder, and so that's a good example. But just another example, just so we can kind of give one more reference of doing it in the field and kind of getting an idea, would be like an open water species, like a striped bass or a wiper. look at the fish. We can see that they are built for extreme speed. They have a, you know, they have a big V-shaped tail, which indicates a fast-moving fish. They have silvery bodies with black lines. That's going to help them to blend in, you know, out both out in the open water as well as among rocky structures. And then also because of the way their mouth is orientated and the way the eye is in relation to that mouth on that fish, we can see, and they're, I should probably clarify, they're kind of looking forward in a sense as opposed to just out. We can tell that that fish is an active hunter. And so we now have an understanding on that fish. So what do you think they're chasing? Just take a guess. You know, in this case, it would probably be bait fish. You could probably be successful with a leech pattern fish to higher up in the water column or mid-depth. So that's kind of important, too. And so when you can't build an actual idea of what's happening with the Internet or books that you have back in the libraries, you can always just take a guess at it and usually be pretty successful. So that's something to think about.
Okay. So, yeah, a lot of just looking at the fish.
Yeah,
but doesn't really, you know, exclude certain activities totally either. I know there's a little koi pond that I go to and feed the koi in this pond, and they're basically like a carp, you know, same kind of turned down mouth, that kind of thing. But they'll come up and take that food off the surface if they're, as we all know, opportunistic, right? Even then, it may not be their primary method of taking food, but they will do it at times. But I think what you're saying is try to get the most common approach, because that's what they're doing most of the time, and that's where you increase your chances of success is by doing the things that meet their common needs on a regular basis.
And I should expand on this real quick, because this is a good example, going back to that carp reference. For carp anglers or people who have tried catching carp, I mean, every fly fisherman wants to catch a big carp on a fly rod. I mean, that's my opinion, whether they'll admit it or not, right? That's what it all, I mean, who doesn't want to catch a big fish, you know?
Well, that's because that's becoming the in thing now, Chad, to catch a big carp.
Yeah. Especially for, you know, guys like me in the city, we have them here, you know. My trout stream, closest one, is 4 hours away now, so. But think about when we go out carp fishing, and, you know, carp regularly school in groups, and so we'll go out and we'll see a school of maybe five of them up at the surface. They're kind of sunbathing. We're all familiar with that. Those fish you probably couldn't cast a fly to and catch if you tried. You'd just spook them. But where there's one, there's many. And so in this case, you know, just because those ones aren't really interested in feeding, you probably shouldn't waste your cast on them because you're just going to spook them. Instead, just stay low and stay out of sight and look to the close shallows where those fish are and then see if there's one that's feeding and then target that one fish, you see, because we know he's feeding and we already know how to catch him, and he'll probably be picking things up off the bottom in those cases. So, and then also the koi reference, you know, if you think about it, you know, those koi would probably be bottom feeders, but they have completely reestablished their food and the way that they feed because, after all, everybody's going and throwing things in the pond. So their feeding experience has been relearned, that the food just falls from the sky and, you know, and all as well.
Right,
so,
right.
Just something to think about.
Well, what about spawning activity with fish? Does it pay to research and study that?
You know, it does. I don't put a whole lot of, I'll be honest with you, I don't put a whole lot of emphasis in spawning, except for a certain, like maybe a couple of different occasions, like walleye, for example. Walleye on a fly are a lot of fun. And, you know, Chatfield every, you know, I didn't go this last year, unfortunately, but the year before, when they were letting a whole lot of water out of that reservoir, there was a whole bunch of walleye that just came up and they were right below the dam. There were anglers everywhere. But, you know, when you have a fly rod, luckily you can clear some space. Everybody's afraid you're going to hook them. I got into a whole bunch of walleye that were there for the spawn and that were there because of all this water coming out. So, you can see certain opportunities, but I don't really put a whole lot of emphasis in it just because, you know, it just kind of depends on the time of year, and it depends. Like, sometimes I almost feel bad, like, going out during the spawn, except for, like, on, you know, like these for walleye and stuff, because that's when it's best to catch them, you know, and you can still practice catch and release, and nobody else will be doing that. But, you know, throughout most of the United States, most of those, you know, most of the spawning now is almost done artificially. You know, they're doing it in the lab to make sure they get the highest count, and, you know, they're doing it lakeside, catching these fish and then releasing them. So, really, you're not even catching so much fish that's in the spawning process. You're catching, in most cases, a post-spawn or a pre-spawn fish, which usually are more aggressive than they normally would be, and they're concentrated in certain locations. So, you know, it is worth it sometimes. In fact, when I wanted to catch a walleye on a fly, I did do research because I wanted, because I had been chasing one for so long and been so unsuccessful that I thought, you know what, I'm going to go out when they spawn. And I did that, and I had a great time. So it is beneficial at times.
I noticed you put a nice chart out on your website about a fish spawning chart for fresh water, and it tells, let's see, what have you, you've got the fish species there, the water temperature, pre-spawn, spawn, and then depth and location as to where they might be spawning. So that chart could come in pretty handy, it seems, to try to locate fish during those times.
Exactly. And I went ahead and just compiled this chart after researching lots and lots of different sites. And this is just kind of an easy reference. One thing that I should probably clarify on this chart is that this is not the guaranteed golden ticket. This is a ballpark figure, you know, in most cases within a few degrees that will help you identify. You can also, you know, fish spawn at a certain time of year, but, you know, like let's say they're spawning in May. You know, what happened last year might not be the same this year. It might be a totally different week. You know, maybe last year was the third week in May. This year it might be the second week in May just because it's warmer or it's colder, you know. And so I do prefer to go by the water temperature for that stuff, as well as the hatch charts on that as well. So.
Yeah, definitely makes a big difference. Where, you know, when we have a fish, and I don't know if your research tells you this or not, but we have a fish, where do we go to look for that fish? Because, like you said, you know, their feeding habits and so forth may be quite different from one another, especially in a large lake that has a lot of different fish. How do you think about going to find those locations?
Well, that's a good question. You know, a lot of it really is just simply common sense, really. And it's, but yet when you show up to the water, you're so overwhelmed. You're just like, where do I begin? What am I supposed to be doing? You know, why am I here? I should have gone to the trout stream. And so, but when you show up, just remember the fundamental of the food chain. I mean, it really is that simple. You know, you want to catch a predator fish, you want to catch a bug eater, you want to catch a fish eater. Think about where their food is. And then think about where that item's food is. So think small and then get bigger. All energy, all original food really comes from the sun. The sun shines, the sun feeds the shallows, you know, and then you can have plants grow. Those plants will then be eaten by crustaceans, worms, leeches, any number of things, bait fish. And then those, and as well as insects, I don't know if I covered that or not, but then those food sources will bring in your bigger fish. And so think about that in relation to what you're seeing out there. That's the general mindset. You can almost always find fish in your shallows or right on the outside of your shallows, you know, in deeper water where they'll be holding, waiting to go back into those shallows when things start to cool down and the sunlight isn't as bright. Other exceptions would be like extreme open water fish. Like you're talking your saltwater fish, striped bass, wiper, white bass on occasion. These fish will go out in huge reservoirs, cover a lot of water, and pursue bait fish by the thousands, sometimes by the millions. Finding these fish can be tough. I don't use a fish finder. I know that some guys do, and that's one way to kind of pinpoint those bait balls. But the other thing that you can do is just really, really be observant. You know, fish the shallows, fish from your boat, and just kind of just see if you can track down some of those bait balls. And if not, you're constantly keeping one eye on the horizon for birds or any sort of disturbance on the surface water. And then when you find that, then you move in and you stay on that location, fish your streamers to match that hatch, and then you stay in that relative area. It's not uncommon for those bait balls to surface, show themselves for maybe only a minute or two, just long enough to let you know that they're there. And then they'll go deep again, deep so that you can't see them. But they're still there. The chance of that bait ball moving a great distance is very, very rare because you've got those predator fish that are going to be constantly keeping that bait ball in a group and keeping, you know, and that bait is going to be looking for strength in numbers. That's the only defense mechanism it has. It's just hoping the next fish gets eaten and it's just trying to maintain itself among the crowd. And so, and then a little bit later, it's not uncommon to see that bait ball maybe surface, maybe upwards of 50, maybe even 60 yards. That would be a pretty big move. and then you can move again to that location. But see, the point is that you're staying on this one bait ball, and you're just continuously moving with that bait ball. That's
right,
one way to
right.
do it.
Okay, well, we need to take another break, but a little note here from Rod Brashears in Texas, who's a longtime listener of the show. He says, in case anybody wants to know, that scotch will loosen up anything. So keep that in mind. Okay, we'll take a little break. We'll be right back. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rod? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles to classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit our website, www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Chad Scheel about fly fishing, Art of War. If you would like to ask Chad a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, a couple of quick questions that came in that kind of relate to fish here, Chad, and then let's move in and cover terrain and finish things up here for folks.
Okay.
Rolf Moser in Switzerland says, Chad, I want to fish for barbel, that's carp, this winter, to bridge the gap between grayling and trout seasons. What tactics and tackle do you recommend, and what kind of nymph looks favorable for a barbel and not taken by the trout? So he might make that brief. I mean, that's a big, it could be a very long answer. But
no, I understand. And, you know, I've never fished in Switzerland, but, you know, the carp is a carp. And my favorite method for fishing carp is actually quite different than most people's. I do not go out and I do not make long casts with streamers and strip them through locations or anything like that. I really, really prefer, especially with the carp, because they are just so sensitive. They will hear you coming from a mile away. I really like to really stay low, find one fish, and then really just pinpoint that fish. I like to walk up slowly on that fish, staying very low. If there's cover, I like to get behind it. If not, I try and get down as low as I can to just make myself seem like the surroundings behind me. Very, very small steps. I try and stay out of the water and just maintain a real quiet approach. I'll try and get myself usually within like 18 feet of that fish, which is extremely close. Most people don't prefer to do that. But I find that making it a large overcast, overhead cast, and then slapping a huge streamer down spooks them far more than I ever would. And then when I get up there, I like to fish a heavy fly that's going to get down right in front of him. And I like to it's a bass fishing tactic of all things, but it's called drop shotting there in a sense. And you basically underarm your fly. You kind of pitch the fly out with your left hand. Or your non-casting hand, and then just kind of lift up slightly with your rod hand, and then as that fly flies into that zone, you just lower your rod to very slowly, and it doesn't make a sound hardly. I mean, it just puts it right in that path of that fish, and then you just kind of wait until he comes by and starts nosing around, and then just give it a couple twitches, and he'll jump right on it. That's my favorite method, and I'm not sure if it's called drop shotting. I know I just called it that, but I think that's what it's called, and it's a great short cast.
Yeah, great tip and technique. Good. Another question from Martin Coleman, Lawrence, Kansas, wants to know what the oddest species, since you've caught so many fish, the oddest one that you've ever caught on a fly rod?
The oddest, well, I'll tell you, the oddest one would probably be my favorite two fish that I've ever caught, just because they were so odd. I got lucky once, and I caught a huge catfish, weighing about 10 pounds, on a dry fly of all things. Never thought I'd see the day. I caught it on a damsel fly. I was out carp fishing, doing this, what I was just telling you, and I was in a float tube just kicking around and being real quiet and just dropping these flies in on these carp and nailing them. And I kept hearing this sucking. You know, we're familiar with that carp sucking, but this was a huge just popping suck. I've never heard anything like this. I thought it was the carp sent to me by the grace of God. I was like thinking this thing was like 60 pounds. It was so loud. It turned out it was a huge catfish, and that huge mouth on that catfish, he was, I don't even know what he was eating. I don't think he was eating anything, but I just kind of meandered around in the water, waiting to hear it again, and when I heard it, the sloppiest cast, he was actually behind me, I just kind of flipped it behind me, and he just dove up and ate it, and it was great. That was one fish. The other fish is called a Garibaldi, and you know, it's in California. It's actually a protected fish. I just got lucky one day. I was out chasing around this other fish called an opal eye. They're everywhere. And I got lucky and caught this really brightly orange-colored fish. And you know, when I saw what I had, I just brought him in as quick as I could. He's not a real strong fish, but absolutely gorgeous. Let him go as quick as I could, and, you know, that's all that the rules required me to do. And that was great. That was once-in-a-lifetime thing. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time, and that was that.
Great.
So.
Great. Well, let's talk about terrain next. By the way, we did get a comment in over the internet that Mike Kozlowski in Oakland says WD-40 will help prevent icing of eyes because it's derived from fish oil, not petroleum. So that might be a tip for people looking for to de-ice them dry.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about terrain. Why is knowing the terrain important, again, as a marine, and then how is this applied to your fly fishing?
Sure. Well, I'll just give the example first. When I was in, you know, just the Marines, we needed to know our terrain. We needed to know, you know, I conducted most of my intelligence work prior to ever even going. I did most of my work here in the States. We would determine paths and places to go that we felt were safest for our unit and that would keep us out of harm's way. And it has more to do with with being able to move quickly in locations. You know, you don't want to get bogged down in the swamp, and you don't, you know, you want solid ground and stuff like that. In the fishing world, terrain is actually one of the pieces that most people really think about when they're in the warm water fishery or when they approach a lake. But having said that, people don't really understand or fully think about the effects that weather has had on its terrain. And that's a huge piece. We also, most fly fishermen kind of tend to underthink the terrain piece. You know, we think of terrain as maybe just a rock jetty or a sunken tree where we might find some bass. But it really is so much more than that. The terrain is everything around the fish. And when you show up to the body of water, that fish already has the upper hand, guaranteed. He has full understanding and knowledge of the terrain he's in. He knows where the best hiding spots are. He knows where the spawning grounds are. He knows where the food is. Everything about it he knows. And you're already kind of at a loss. And so when you show up, what I like to do is really broaden my horizons about what is terrain. And I look at the terrain to not only include the rocks and jetties and such, but, you know, to include weeds and sand and gravel flats, the jetties, you know, your tides are a form of terrain because fish can use that to hide, and they'll move in and out of it. That's a changing element. Cloud cover, you know, the shade that is cast down on the lake, you know, especially if it's blotchy, if you have, you know, spots of shade, but the rest of it's sunny, that is a terrain feature. That becomes a terrain feature because those fish will seek out those areas. You know, as well as the water that they're in. You know, what is the water doing? And so from there, I will think, where would this, whatever species of fish you're pursuing, where would I find that species of fish primary location? And so let's just do one for the smallmouth bass. What do we know about the smallmouth bass? We know that the smallmouth bass prefers sand, gravel, and rocks, you know, as its primary structure. Okay, we know that lately, you know, maybe the water is murky, you know, maybe we got a recent rainstorm or something. There's a very good chance that maybe those fish are in the shallows a little bit, kind of taking advantage of that opportunity because some new food and stuff has been washed into the body of water. So now I can think, okay, it might not work, but, you know, at least it's an educated assessment and putting me on a location based on some actual knowledge about what I know and what's happened to from the weather and such, and then I can start fishing that location. And when I get there, it might be a huge area. You know, we've just now, you know, maybe it's an area that's a whole square mile, you know, a huge gravel flat. When you get there, you've found the primary location for the fish. Now start pinpointing those specific locations, those sunken trees, maybe that huge, you know, that huge rock mound out in the middle of the lake or something. Then start keying in on those key features that we tend to only think about, but more importantly, think about the big piece. So,
talking in generalities here, but again, down in the Florida Keys, when the tide goes in and out, it really changes the terrain of the underwater terrain because, you know, what was a feeding area is now dry, you know, mm-hmm. that 20 minutes before was the fish were feeding in. And then it also creates, you know, moving water into flowing streams almost, you know, between the keys. So there that brings in a lot of food, you know, and other fish going by where it becomes ambush spots. So it's really interesting how, you know, 20, 30 minutes can change the terrain in a lot of places and change it into a whole different fishing strategy that you have to use and tactics that you have to use.
Yeah, and in the salt water, like you said, it's huge. Things change there on the minute, you know. The change is always slower in your rivers and your, you know, your lakes and reservoirs for the most part. But, you know, because, yeah, the tides, I mean, they just change everything so quick.
I think another thing that, you know, when we think about terrain and trying to identify it is that there are only specific places that these fish will be in say, a lake or someplace. I mean, we look out this big expanse of lake and wonder, well, where the heck are the fish? But they're usually in a very limited area of the lake and not, I know when we talk to Denny Rickards about fishing for trout in the lakes, you know, they're in a very, unless it's a bottom feeding lake trout or something, but they're usually in a very limited zone, and you just have to identify those zones, and some of them can easily be eliminated too, like maybe a steep rocky shoreline on a reservoir that doesn't hold fish, but then when you get starts to flatten out and get into, you know, 5-6 foot level, then you start to have a terrain that's more, you know, inviting to the fish. So
exactly, and you know, the important thing to remember too is that Some of these locations in your terrain, these fish will not be going there to feed. They'll, you know, like we talked about, you know, they're going to rest too. You know, they're not going to be interested in food so much sometimes. So, you know, like, it's funny because I've done a lot of diving this last year. Well, not diving, but snorkeling and filming and stuff. And I was really amazed at how many fish I found throughout the lake. You know, they were scattered everywhere, but most of those fish were just kind of hanging out, they resting. They weren't interested in feeding or anything. Where I found feeding occurring, I found fish in concentration. And that's what we need to try and target. We need to try and find fish in concentration, because if you do that, you'll have a great day. You'll have an absolute awesome day. It'll be the day that you'll want to remember forever. You know, whereas, you know, if you just go out and you're just kind of casting, you don't find the concentration of fish, you'll still have a relaxing day. You'll still be out and, you know, a day of no fish is better than a day in the office, but, you know, it's always fun to find them in concentration.
Yeah.
That's what this approach is trying to do.
Yeah, sometimes it all seems to come together. I know we were fishing for northern pike up in way northern Manitoba, and on one afternoon, a storm had come in. This is where kind of all things come together. A storm was blowing across the lake, clouds, driving rain, wind. And we were in a little bay area, and it had pushed, evidently, the bait fish into this bay area. And there were so many bait fish in this area, and the pike were just going crazy. And literally, when you threw something like a fly in the water or anything, the bait fish would come out of this thing like popcorn. Like, you know, popcorn, just 50 of them jumping out of the water because they're scared, you know, because something just hit the water. And we had, just like you said, a day we'll never, you know, well, let's say an hour we'll never forget, because every cast was a fish. And it was just because the weather had concentrated everything into the terrain, you know, which was an isolated area, and the big fish were in there on top of the little fish, and just all hell was breaking loose, you know. But it sure made fishing a lot of fun.
Well, and that reminds me of a funny story. Do we have time to tell a quick story? I think
and we just need to pull all this together when you're done.
Okay, why don't we just go ahead and do, well, you know what, I'll tell the story and kind of tell you how to do all that at the same time.
Okay.
You know. Okay, so the most important thing to remember about, you know, using the wet approach, weather, enemy terrain, is that you're covering all aspects of the fishery. Everything, you know, you can throw anything in the mix, a hatch. We can put a hatch somewhere in here. Okay, and I like to put that under the enemy, or the fish, because then so many fish will pick up on certain hatches. Your terrain is fitting somewhere. You got all these different structures of the terrain fitting into a group. You got your weather fitting into a group. It helps you develop the weather effects on the terrain. It helps you develop the weather effects that will affect the fish. And then it helps you to kind of start making an assessment on where those fish will be at a certain time of the day, or, you know, whatever's happening out there. That's important. It's not a guaranteed method. There's no guarantees in fishing. But it is a way to organize your thoughts, to really start pinpointing your fishing. And what you'll find in most cases is that when you show up to the water, take 10 minutes to look things over and say, okay, this is what I'm going to do. You put together these three elements, and then you start fishing in that location. You might be off a little bit, but you'll catch more fish there than you would have if you had just started fishing. And then from there, then you can start saying, okay, what have I noticed over the course of the fishing since I started catching these fish at this location? I've noticed that they've been aggressive takes. Well, that tells you that maybe, you know what, they're willing to move a little bit faster. And so you can start moving things a little bit faster, and you might start picking up more fish. See, now you're in the ballpark. You know, you're not outside on the sidewalk listening to the ball game. You're actually in the ballpark. But you're way up in, you know, the bloody nose section, way up there, you know, up high. You can't hardly see the game, but at least you're seeing the game. But now you can start nitpicking things and getting closer and closer and closer to your objective until you're like almost right on top of it. And then right about that time, when everything seems to fall in place, everything seems to fall apart because things start changing. But then you start thinking, okay, we're in a location. Now, what changes have I seen and experienced, and how is that going to affect the fish that I've already been catching? And then start making your changes again. And so you're constantly reevaluating things and moving. And if you do that, it changes your fishing entirely. It's a whole nother ball game on the water. It really is. And I'll end just with a quick story. I know we're running out of time. A story about wiper fishing. My folks live in North Platte, Nebraska. And every spring, I like to go out there, and I love to chase wiper out there. I'm the only guy who does it with a fly rod. I've almost become, you know, the crazy guy. They all think I'm crazy when I first show up because they're like, oh, my gosh, a fly. You know, these guys are all planting bait on the bottom. And I go out there, and even though I could really fish deep and do what everyone else is doing, I start thinking, what do I know about this fish? And I start putting presentations out that are fast and quick moving. And about 2 years ago, I was out there, had a great weekend of fishing, tons of people. I mean, the banks were littered with people. We're all catching fish occasionally. People are putting the bait below the fish, and I'm running it right through their feeding grounds. So I was catching a whole bunch of fish. My dad was getting a whole bunch of fish. And then things just kind of ended all of a sudden, you know, for no reason. So we just kind of packed up and went home. We had already had a great day. And then we went out the next couple of days, and things had really kind of slowed down. They were in the inlet at the time, and they had started moving back out into the open lake. I went back out there late night. I was supposed to be driving back to Denver to get home. I had work the next day. But I decided that I would go and try one more time. It was a weeknight, and I thought, you know what? I know the fish probably aren't feeding there. It's kind of a unique time because the inlet's open, and there's a whole bunch of water coming in, and they're there to take advantage of all that nutrients and stuff that's coming in with the new water. And it was kind of coming to a close. So I just went down there, and it was on fire. I was the only person there. I must have caught 50 wiper within a few hours. It was just absolute dynamite. I fished until dark, and it got dark pretty late. I was getting on the road at like 9 o'clock. I had to drive home like 4 hours. And on the way in, I realized, it wasn't until I got on the road that I realized why fishing was so great. Because on my way out, I hit a massive storm. I mean, the biggest storm that I had probably ever been in my life. And, I mean, it was just downpouring. There was thunder, and it was just crazy. I almost didn't think I'd get home that night. Got home, and I realized, you know, on my drive, I'm thinking about all this. I'm like, man, I was just in the right place, you know. When I got home, it turns out that pressure system soon moved over into North Platte and the lake where I was. It's my personal feeling that those fish knew that. They were moving into that inlet one more time to take advantage of things before, you know, a great change possibly caused things to stop. That's my opinion. And yeah. So, you know, that's just how I feel about it.
Yeah, yeah. Particular change things all around again. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one thing I've gotten out of this, too, and sometimes, you know, you can't see the forest for the trees, but, you know, we always recommend people when they're going to a new area to get a guide, you know,
yeah.
And then learn about the fish, learn about the terrain, learn about the weather, learn about their feeding habits, and then go try it on your own. And there's so much to that because I was just thinking as you were talking, too, you know, a lot of people keep journals, too, and record, you know, when they caught a fish, what the weather was like, and so forth. So many of us will bounce around and fish this river one day and another river the next day and this lake the next day, and we never really get to know a piece of water intimately. And I think, you know, if you took one piece of water and got to know it intimately with all the things that you've talked about tonight, then you'll really have learned about how to look and understand and how to approach that piece of water. But because we don't spend enough time in one place, we never tend to do that. So that's my little, you know, revelation that I got out of this.
You know, the nice thing, too, is if you really got to know a piece of water like that, you would really learn to identify these elements and its effect on your fishery. And
right.
You'd see it firsthand. If you would see it firsthand, and then you'd know that, you know, it really does work, and that you can then apply that to other places. But, yeah, like you said, the best thing you can do, especially when you first show up, is just get a guide, because, I mean, these guys are out there every day. It is their piece of water. And, you know, they're going to know. You know, they're going to say, hey, we got a light rainstorm. They might even be able to pick it down to the detail. You know, we got like a quarter inch, you know, and that means this will be good right here, but this here won't, and you probably would have gone, you know, it's just ridiculous how much knowledge some of these guides have. It's fascinating, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
great.
I totally agree with you. Absolutely.
Well, unfortunately, Chad, it's time to wrap things up.
Well, darn.
But when we return, we're going to give away the 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine and those 2 gift certificates you so kindly offered up. So stick with us here, folks, and we'll get those gifts in just a moment. Just as Lance Armstrong says, Live Strong, there's a fly fishing organization that's helping women battle cancer to fish on. It's Reeling and Healing Midwest. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature, and a support network which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can help support their retreats, visit reelingandhealingmidwest.org. Reelingandhealingmidwest.org. Or call them at 866-237-5725. 866-237-5725. Well, just as a quick reminder to everyone, and before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage, and it's in Chad's section there, and it says, what do you think of this show? Just click on that, leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. And by the way, your comments are posted out on the site when you go back to any of the speakers page and look at the shows. You'll see right below that link so you can read the comments there. So now it's time to give away prizes. Winners for drawings tonight are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register yet for tonight's show, it's a little too late, but make sure you do it for the next show because we're always giving away some nice prizes. So we're going to do the drawing first, and the first thing is for a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And you can find out more about the Federation of Fly Fishers by going to www.fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. Great organization to support, and there's plenty of things to learn this. So, from our registration database, we've got a winner, and it's Justin Samborin. Justin Samborin in Pennsylvania. So, congratulations, Justin. I'm sure you'll enjoy that membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. Okay, second thing is 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. And Fly Fusion Magazine, a magazine out of Calgary, Canada. You can find out more about them at flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. Excellent magazine if you haven't seen it. And our winner there is Andre Beltran in California. Andre Beltran, so he's our winner of that Fly Fusion Magazine subscription. Terrific. Okay, now for our big prizes for this evening, and courtesy of Chad Scheel and EmergeFishing.com, Chad's going to give away a couple of gift certificates, a $50 gift certificate and a $25 gift certificate. So, Chad, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to ask a question, and the first person that answers it correctly will get the $50 gift certificate, and the second person that answers it correctly will get the $25. Okay, and I'm going to ask you to make sure we get the right answer on this question when I ask it. Now, folks, you got to enter your your answer on the homepage in that text box. Be sure to put your name and your location in there. If you don't have both those things, you're going to not be qualified. So the question is, and this is an easy one, if you've been with us for the night, is what does the acronym WET stand for? What does the acronym WET stand for? So, Chad, if they missed this one, we really didn't do our job properly, I think.
I hope not.
That's a pretty easy one, isn't it?
Well, I already forgot, Roger.
You already forgot?
Oh, wait. Yeah.
You're not that old, Chad. Yeah, that forgetfulness is for guys like me.
There you go.
Well, I'm checking here. Where are you guys? Let's have some answers here. Jared Sartini in Holland. Looks like, I guess it's Holland, the country. It says water, enemy, terrain. Was he right? Weather, enemy, terrain.
Weather, enemy, terrain. That's correct. Yep.
That's correct. So Jared's our first winner. And then our second, let's see, Andrew Zelnick in Liberty, Missouri says weather, enemy, terrain. So it looks like we got two winners there right off the bat, the first two coming in. Gentlemen that won here, Jared and Andrew, what you need to do, and you can do this through the same text box you just sent this through, is send me your mailing address, your email address, phone number would be good too, so that Chad can contact you, and I don't know if he'll deliver. Are you going to deliver these electronically or by mail, Chad?
If you just want to forward the information to me, I can just go ahead and contact the individuals and set up something, because both of them were out of country, so I'll just decide something.
No, one is in Missouri.
Oh, for
one is in Missouri.
Jared was in
Holland. Jared's in Holland. So be sure Andrew's already given us his email, so we'll contact you, Andrew, and get the other information. And then, Jared, send us your email so that we can contact you that way. And we'll get you your gift certificates, which you can redeem at merchfishing.com. Okay, well, that does that. Chad, real pleasure talking to you tonight. I enjoyed it, learned a lot, and I hope everybody else did as well. It's made me want to think more seriously about, you know, how I approach things. So if nothing else, it kind of rattles the cage a little bit and gets us back on track. So
great.
Thanks for being with us,
and hopefully
we can talk again.
Sounds good.
Okay. Our next broadcast will be on December 3rd at 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and on that show we'll interview Kelly Gallup, and our topic on the show will be cripples and spinners. Kelly Gallup will help us to understand how cripples and spinners play an important role in trout's diet and how to fish them effectively. So come and join us on that show, and you'll learn some of Kelly's secrets. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Platte River Fly Shop, Keeney's Fly Shop, Pierre Marquette River Lodge, and Power Fibers Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115, extension 2, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Again, that's 888-961-1115, extension 2. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcement so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.